My name is Maureen Starkey. I'm the moderator for this, and we're going to get started. We're going to talk about getting kids to think about things they haven't thought about before. Stretch their, you know, exercise their minds. This is good for adults, too. I've been, me personally, just let you know who I am, and I'll pass it on to everybody else and give a small bio on themselves. I've been 30 years in the computer game industry. I'm an illustrator. I'm a Hugo nominee this year for Best Fan Artist, which goes to show when you have nothing else to do, volunteering your time is a great thing. And I also was art director for Namco and created Pac-Man's arch enemy, the Ghost Lord, which is an exercise in thinking outside the box. That would be helpful. Anyway, I'll pass it on to you.
My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University in New York City, about in 2 weeks to start my ninth year there, which is hard to believe. I teach courses in creative writing and fantasy and science fiction as well, so that kind of fits. And I'm also a writer. First novel came out 2 years ago, and next two are being shopped as we speak. And the last thing I'll mention is that I also run a podcast called Speculate, which is the podcast for writers, readers, and fans. I co-host that with Brad Bollier, who's another speculative fiction author, and we have had a chance to interview a number of authors, editors, artists, even game designers, and all things related to the speculative fiction field, and that's also something we can tie into this as well. So that's the deal with me.
You do have there's your name.
Yeah. My name here?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was...
No, Daniel's...
No.
It's a friend of Mo.
Gary Wolf.
You got me. I'm Gary Wolf.
Oh, Gary Wolf.
I thought
okay,
I was...
So sorry.
I said I was like,
I'm
what?
I thought I
didn't want to rename him Daniel. That's permission.
I can't see Daniel. That far anyway.
You can do anything you want to me. I'm late. It's my fault.
Need some water.
So you have to introduce yourself since you've...
My name is Gary Wolf. In terms of teaching, I've been teaching at Roosevelt University in Chicago for longer than most of you have been alive. And I also write a review column for Locus Magazine and do academic... Okay, thank you. I've been writing a review column for Locus Magazine for 20 years and have done academic studies of science fiction, not specifically for the textbook market, but for academics. So I've taught it off and on for a while.
I should mention, by the way, that we interviewed Jonathan Strahan, who talked about Coot Street Podcast with you.
Let's talk about that.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Stephen Potson, by all means, let any of us know if we need to be leaning into the mic. I think it's on, but I'm used to shouting to large groups of people. I teach in the literature program at UCSD, mostly genre fiction. I publish some science fiction and parodies and other things like that, but most of my work is in the critique of this field. And I'm not exactly sure why they put me in particular on this panel, but maybe they were thinking outside the box. I'm willing to go along.
I'm Margaret McGaffey Fisk. I have published a number of short stories, and I have a chapter in the author's grimoire, which is about the process of writing. Not my chapter. My chapter is about rejections. I have a lot of them.
Mm.
And I also teach creative writing courses, just short courses, either through online websites or at conventions. And I teach both science fiction and general writing courses in ways that are oddly out of the box. So I figure I'm exactly where I should be.
Mm-hmm. So many of us here are teachers wanting to know how we can get the kids to think. How do you go about doing a what if? With your students or somebody new to get them to think about a new world. I'm going to throw out an example. I remember reading Ursula Le Guin said, you know what it's like to stand out in the moonlight. Now think about what it would be like to be on a planet that has two moons. You would have two shadows, mm-hmm, instead of one. So just doing a fundamental, simple, basic thing like that, and then to extrapolate on that. How do you guys go about it?
Well, there are so many ways, it's hard to know where to start, right? I guess I can just think of two. This afternoon, I sat in on a panel that took place a couple of rooms away, which is creating believable physics. We were just discussing that because she also attended. And one of the things, we thought it was going to be about, you know, how science fiction writers actually can make their extrapolations of physics seem credible. What really came out of the panel is the difficulty physicists, real working physicists, have coming up with believable physics, you know. And Gregory Benford, a physicist, science fiction writer, spent a good deal of time trashing string theory because there is nothing testable in string theory. There's an example. And I'm particularly fond myself of alternate history. I've known Harry Turtledove for a long, long time. We share a birthday, so we send each other birthday greetings every year, noting how old the other one is getting. That's trying to figure out what is a credible departure point, not only what makes a good story, but what is actually a credible departure point. These are all, of course, Gedanken Experimenten, to use the term that's associated with Einstein and his methods for imagining what relativity would actually be like before or while he was devising the mathematics of relativity. There are so many departure points. In other words, whether you're dealing with something as bound by mathematics as physics or something that's not like history. So I'll toss that out.
My question to you right now is, how much are we talking about teaching students who want to write science fiction or teaching students how to read science fiction? Because the students I have are only, I'm trying to break down certain barriers in terms of reading, that you can't make assumptions about the world that you make with any other kind of fiction. So how many of you are dealing with students who are trying to learn how to read science fiction? Okay. And those of you who are trying to write science fiction? Only one.
And what about the third category? How many of you are in here because you want to figure out ways to incorporate science fiction in your curriculum?
Yes.
Yeah. Now we're getting started.
Okay.
I would say that's something that I do in my writing classes a lot, is because science fiction and fantasy both offer opportunities to wake people up, to make them think, without hitting them over the head. You can take a course in philosophy and learn all of these different philosophical positions and choose which ones you want to follow and all such, but it's a very mental exercise. What I like doing is giving somebody, for example, describe to me. One of the classes I taught was on teaching description, but it also exposed people to how they look at things. So describe to me a kitchen. You know, well, it has a stove, it has a sink. Now describe to me the kitchen that's in the 1800s. Describe to me the kitchen that's on a spaceship. It gives you the opportunity to look at your assumptions. What do you assume when you hear those words? And how can you translate that to a different culture or society or timeline? And that's where science fiction is useful.
Let me take two stabs at this, if I may, to respond a little bit to Gary's question. Because I think there are two separate things that can tie together here. For those who want to think outside the box or teach their students to think outside the box about writing science fiction, I would point out that it can sometimes be an interesting exercise to have students who are interested in reading science fiction do a little, just a little, bit of writing it as one avenue for them understanding how they might read it. That's often very helpful, although it's at a very basic, simple level, and you don't want to make a literature course a composition course. But there are, I think, ways to incorporate some of these things, maybe some of which we can talk about later. But one of the things I do in my creative writing writing course on the writing side is to get students thinking about creative writing from the perspective of other creative disciplines. So I typically will bring in people who are professional comedians, I've had professional game designers, I've had professional artists, and I've had professional musicians, even a professional dancer, come in and speak to my class about the creative process for them. And one of the things that's helpful for is they're then able to, number one, transfer some of the things about creativity which are common to all disciplines. Number one, discipline. You don't just sit down and, you know, full-blown, like from the mind of Zeus, a book springs forward on the page. That's not the way it works. Sadly, for those who thought it would be an easy elective, not so. That's the first thing, discipline. And then the second thing, the fact that all of us are inspired, passionate about what it is that we do and feel the need to express it in given, you know, artistic medium, dance, sculpture, writing, you know, visual arts, that sort of thing. And so those things are often helpful for them in terms of creativity and writing. On the reading side, on the other side about actually reading science fiction and fantasy, one of the things that I find the big challenge for me teaching students where I am, and normally what I'm doing is teaching essentially introductory courses to science fiction and fantasy. I've finally got the university to split the course, which is a blessing. So I can now do a semester in science fiction, then a semester in fantasy, thank heavens. So I have more time to do both. But one of the things I typically find is getting my students to think outside of the box of what they assume science fiction usually is. Because they come in with a general knowledge of what science fiction shows them in TV, on movie screens, and what they get a lot of on TV and movie screens in science fiction is dystopian future where everything dies. Name me a science fiction movie that's big that hasn't done that. There's certainly many that are some that are out there, but a vast majority of them, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, have been about things that die, right? Things that, what happens when the world blows up, right? And everything is this stunning new vision. I never understand how it can be stunning and new when everyone is doing the same stunning new vision of how everyone's going to die. You know, but anyway, so they have that vision. And then the other vision they have of science fiction, typically in specific, is the sort of the whiz-bang, the lasers, the shooting aliens in outer space and all that kind of thing. And so one of the things that I'm trying to get them to do is to see science fiction in a number of different ways. One, that it can often be much more quiet, more intimate, more individual, more based upon relationships between creatures and not simply, you know, one metal spaceship to another metal spaceship, you know, which is kind of the thing that they sometimes have in their mind. And then secondly, that science fiction and fantasy both have deeply philosophical aspects that don't get represented well in just the whiz-bang, right? That part of what we remember about the fantasy and science fiction that we love is the stuff that made us think long after we shut the TV off, shut the movie screen, shut the movie off, or close the page. And those are the sorts of things that they find the most interesting. So I've often had students come up to me afterwards and say, you know, this I didn't think we were going to talk about that much philosophy, you know, which means that I'm doing my job. I mean, not in a bad way, I hope. They all tell me this because they seem to be enjoying it. And that's one of the nice things, is to show them the richness, the depth of this particular field that isn't just about cool technology and cool lasers, but really is about the very intimate, localized, creature-to-creature interactions that can happen in some of the best fantasy and science fiction, too. So that's for the reading crowd, I'd say.
I think that's related to the business about describing a kitchen. Describing a real kitchen in the real world is a baseline. That's baseline fiction writing. Describing other fiction.
That's where you start.
Yes, that's where you start.
Yep.
For about 40 years, Daniel Keyes taught fiction writing at Ohio University. But Daniel Keyes has written, I would say, one of the half dozen most famous science fiction stories of the 20th century, Flowers for Algernon. So, of course, all the students wanted to go into Daniel Keyes' class. It was a two-semester class on creative writing because they read Flowers for Algernon. And the first semester, he wouldn't let them write science fiction. They all wanted to write science fiction. His argument was, show me a good story. Show me a good story that has a real kitchen in it, and in the second semester, I'll let you reimagine that from science fiction. His argument being that any science fiction or fantasy story begins, as you say, as being a good story that deals with character, that deals with ideas.
Yeah.
Science fiction is, his point was this. His point was that science fiction, especially, is harder than realistic fiction. Because science fiction has to begin with realistic fiction and alter it.
Yeah.
And if you can't do realistic fiction, you don't know what you're altering.
Yeah,
yeah, and I think to follow up on something that I really agree with Gregory on here, so much of our, and why science fiction sometimes gets a bad rap, you know, in the culture at large, where most people just see the movies or see the television shows.
Yep.
Because, in fact, what those The two genres you mentioned, for instance, generally Earth people versus aliens, and the Earth does not abide, you know.
Right.
These actually don't offer thinking outside the box. These offer closure. They offer familiarity. And I know, because it's interesting, I went to see one of the latest Humans versus Aliens just this last weekend, and it was Cowboys versus
Aliens.
It was not Cowboys versus Aliens, it's Cowboys and Aliens.
I know that. But it is, the scenario is, you know, the Cowboys versus Aliens. And what I thought was clever about it was the way it actually played with the conventions of both genres.
Exactly, the Western. You know, it's not a bad Western.
This is really about genre versus genre and genre.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Rather than, and I saw it that way, in kind of a metafictional way. But one of the ads for coming attractions is for that, I think it's a Brad Pitt vehicle. The one of, I think it was one with him. Either confusing it with the baseball one.
You talk about the zombie one?
I'm talking about the one where there's a disease that's knocking everybody.
Contagion.
Oh, Contagion. Contagion. Not Brad Pitt. It's Matt Damon.
Brad Pitt and everybody.
It's Matt Damon. I knew it was somebody from the last Ocean's 12.
So younger Dustin Hoffman doing Outbreak.
Yeah.
That's
great. Yeah, that's right. And that is
thinking
so
outside the box.
But it's so familiar, once again, the Contagion thing. And the problem is, the version of science fiction we tend to see coming out of Hollywood is, okay, which category can we put this in so we know what kind of PR campaign to engineer? And very little that's really thinking outside the box can get into those big media, because they count on the audiences actually recognizing the story before they walk into the theater.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I want to speak to that, but it relates in the way that I hear that a lot at science fiction conventions, especially that concept of they're repeating the same stories so that people will recognize them. One thing that we're seeing is that the younger generations aren't being pulled into science fiction as much, partially because it's not called science fiction, it's called young adult fantasy or young adult fiction, and then they go to adult fiction, which isn't. However, part of the thing is, for them, all these movies, all these books are new. They're brand new concepts. They haven't read the books that were published 60 years before.
Right.
And so some of that reoccurrence, and that's something to pay attention to in the classroom, is it's new to them. It's fresh. It's one of the reasons why Aragon was so popular in that age group. A lot of the older people read it and said, oh, well, this is a ripoff of this. It's a lousy book. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the younger people read it and said, oh, my God, this is incredible! Because they didn't have the same framework. And that's something that when you're bringing science fiction into your classroom, you have to make sure, as science fiction fans, as people who know the history, you have to make sure that you're recognizing that to them, it doesn't have that history. It's a blank page.
I think it's also important to play off that. I think it's important to, despite what we've just said about inside-the-box thinking in Hollywood and how that can be frustrating, that the one benefit we have is that you have students who are predisposed. I'm not sure that I entirely agree that they're being pulled out of science fiction. I know what you mean, that maybe it's being called something different. But my experience is that my students have become, based on enrollments, kind of anecdotal evidence I recognize, but increasingly interested in science fiction and fantasy, and aren't just coming into my class because they think it's an easy elective, which it isn't, but because they're coming into it finding these things fascinating for them. And one of the things that I have to do, and we have to do as teachers and professors and people who are working with these groups, is to be able to, in some ways, validate that part of what they view. I get some students who almost kind of tentatively, is X-Men science fiction? You know, because they're expecting to get, no, what it actually, peasant, it's H.G. Wells, or, you know, and they want me to, and one of the things that we have to do, I think, is to be conscious of the science fiction that speaks to them generationally as much as anything else. And if we can validate these things, which are working off of tropes given to us by Wells and Verne and all these other people that we're talking about, if we can validate those for them, it gives us, it's half the battle is won at that point, because the assumption on their part then is that we are collectively working together to understand this this field. And we have more understanding, experience, knowledge of it because we've been at it longer and we've studied it, but not that we possess some kind of knowledge, the key of which will never be made clear except to the very few, right? That, I think, is the real danger, is when you set up this kind of barrier between us and them. And so from my point of view, validating really some of the stuff that they found, which is legitimate science fiction for sure, but then also, as I said, trying to show them other aspects that Hollywood doesn't show as much that's also science fiction, but validating what they know as science fiction is important to show that generationally their choices matter too from the point of view of speculative fiction.
Absolutely. Because there is or was a sense that you had to read the Bible before you could speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that Bible got longer each generation.
Yeah, right.
So there's...
Sorry, I blanked.
That was the
senior moment. The Cowboys versus Aliens, to me, so much of what is being produced in Hollywood on the science fiction front smacks very much of the old cowboy westerns. You use lasers instead of six guns, and you have Wookiees instead of Indians. And I mean, even Lucas says that's the niche that the Wookiee plays. And trying to get kids to think about, going back to, you need a firm foundation in which to it's like you need your feet rooted so that your head can be in the clouds. Because otherwise you just topple over. The kids need to know that, when they're thinking about... I'm a visual artist, so and you can tell because I don't talk that well. it's mostly scenes and scenarios that I put together. My students, I put... using Ursula Le Guin's... when she said, imagine yourself on a moonlit night and there's two moons instead of just one. Well, everybody knows what a one moon is and one shadow. Well, what if your sky's a different color? How does that affect people? How does that affect, your normal, you walk into the grocery store. What if all of a sudden, your trees have silver leaves instead of green leaves? Would a green tree be the abnormal? Getting them to really observe. Oh, the best example is René Magritte. You're familiar with the Dadaist. Well, he's classified as a Dadaist, but he's not. He really wasn't. He said, "I paint stone birds not to make you think that there are birds made out of stone. Did I paint stone birds so that you will stop and think about what a bird really is?" And that's what you do when you look at that picture. You see the stone bird floating. And that's what science fiction, to me, that's what science fiction does. It's not so much that, and it has come to pass. We've got cell phones, our communicators, because it has sparked people's imagination. And there's some people that say, well, there are no obstacles. We can make communicators. We can make them really small. But we also stop and think about how, what our life really is without a flying car, what we have to do. And it changes. And I wanted to address a thing about the new generation that's coming up now, in the last 5 years. They've lived with cell phones. It's hard for them to read a story where somebody has to search for a payphone to continue the plot.
Yeah.
Because they say, why don't they just get their cell phone? Well, that wasn't... It brought home to me that there's this timeline and we're rushing so fast that our children really can't catch up onto our lifetime's history. See, I knew more about my mom's history during World War II than my daughter understands about the first Iraq invasion. We're moving so fast. The history is just kind of like... And unfortunately, we do have... there was a generation that moved into Marvel Comics that felt, that had no sense of history and felt that all this older artwork that was being done was resource material for themselves. And we saw a lot of regurgitation of, you know, and so we saw a lack of imagination. We just saw people basically plagiarizing. You know, moving forward, using the past, mining the past instead of really understanding their history.
Or being in dialogue with it.
Yes.
Or being in dialogue.
Yes.
One of the important aspects of that is not just teaching them that that they're not just teaching. No, it's okay.
I wanted to say the reason I said that was because, as far as I'm concerned, Aragon is a mashup of a lot of things that inspired this young man to write this story, and all that was already written. And you know, for whatever reason, it still smacks to me of just regurgitation of you know, I don't want it to sound negative either, because it's like when you read your child a story and they want you to read it to them again and again and again. And the reason that you think, why don't they get tired of the story? But what it is, every time you read it to them, they're getting control of the story. They know where they are in it. And they, especially one if it relates to them.
But again,
the mashup, the taking, you know, yeah. I'm going to take some Peter Pan, and I'm going to take some Anne McCaffrey, and I'm going to take this, and I'm going to make my own. And it's just so obvious that it's not quite that. That's where it's imitative. It's not creative.
Well,
except that the trouble is Tolkien is also.
Oh yeah,
I mean the mashup. Modern fairy tales are remixes of the original fairy tales in which everybody dies, just so you know.
But I think there's a difference, though, between doing what Tolkien... I mean, the difference to me is in nuance. It's in how one constructs the world and for what purposes. If you're literally just thinking to yourself that you're involved in a kind of self-indulgent project of, you know, it would be cool if Thor was fighting with the Incredible Hulk, and what would that be like, you know? And that's can be cool and fun in its own way, but it's not going to have the same kind of resonance, let's say, as someone who's trying to put these things together to create a, as Tolkien saw it, a uniquely Anglo-Saxon mythology, something which wasn't available to him. He could pull on ancient myths, but the mythologies that he knew were Norman in orientation, not really Anglo-Saxon. And so he was trying to develop something different. So, I mean, look, if you go back to the writers that we consider the greatest writers, Shakespeare has not one single original plot. Not one. No original plots. What makes Shakespeare Shakespeare is not the plot, it is the way in which he draws, or even the themes. What makes Shakespeare Shakespeare is the way in which he deploys theme, plot, character. You know, King Lear howling in the storm about the loss of his understanding of what life means has incredible resonances before you have a child, after you have a child, when you're coming to the end of your life. The reason it has those many levels is because Shakespeare is drawing upon all of these things that we see as universal truths that are important to us, whether it's love or the loss of love or all of these things, and it's the way in which he deploys them that matters, because Shakespeare wasn't doing it for self-indulgence. Shakespeare was doing it for communication. He wanted to communicate these things to other people, and as in ancient days, sitting around a fire, remember when we saw this happen? Remember when we had the same thoughts in our minds? We thought about these emotions or these, you know, whatever the case may be. That's what Shakespeare draws upon, although what he's writing about is not particularly unique. It's the way in which he writes it that's unique. And I think that's one of the things about sort of thinking outside the box, is that it's not even necessarily the subject matter per se. It's the way in which one deploys the subject matter. And that's the difference between taking a bunch of stuff and mashing it up and taking things and having a dialogue with each other. For instance, very quickly, I teach in my fantasy course Beowulf followed by Grendel, Gardner's unbelievably, astonishingly prophetic in some ways book, despite the fact that it's looking backwards in some ways to Beowulf. And nobody knew Beowulf better than Gardner. No one. And yet what Gardner is able to do in that book is provide an extraordinary psychological reference on the times. He's able to tie together philosophy and even some aspects of scientific inquiry and put it all together in the form of this book. Well, my students love that book in part because they recognize that Grendel is not some self-indulgent project about, well, it would be really cool if the monster thought for himself, but it would be really cool if the monster, like we do, my 18 to 21-year-old students think, wonder who the heck we are and what we're doing in this world. And so the way in which Gardner deploys those things that students think about anyway and does that in dialogue with something which is fundamental to fantasy, Beowulf, as one of the, you know, seminal things that people draw upon for their own work, that's really what makes the difference, I think. It's the difference between a mashup and a dialogue.
You have to make it new.
Yeah.
And in order to, you can start with raw materials that are available to everyone, but you have to make it new. You have to have a new vision. Yep. A new vision. And really, I mean, just talking about science fiction in connection with any of the other conventional genres or with the nonfiction material that we present in classrooms, you know, and I'm glad you mentioned that thing about the cell phone, and because I was thinking the same thing. How many times you see a classic thriller in which, oh my gosh, the first thing the burglar does is cut the phone lines, or the kidnappers have cut the phone lines, and nowadays, yeah, 911, you know, yeah.
But of course, it could be that it wasn't charged. How many?
No, I know. And so now they've had to come up with that.
So you have different. Yeah, you have different plot.
Yeah, or you go to Radio Shack and you can get them and get a cell phone damper.
Well, someone said something about the percentage of cell phones that fail in horror movies relative to anything. Bars, you know, like the more the
network. Instead of throwing the gun, you throw the cell phone.
The horror writers do not want networks to get better, folks. They want networks to get worse. You know.
On the same hand, they'll be, you know, 3 miles in an underground bunker, and they're like, oh, But you know, and you gotta get kids to think about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, I was going to use an example when I was with Namco. The assignment came to me. I had to make Pac-Man's arch enemy. This would be his arch enemy from the beginning. Well, I don't know if any of you know, being a visual artist, you having to come up with a mature cartoon character. That's really difficult. They worked really hard to do that with Roger Rabbit, and they did a really good job. You know, even Bugs Bunny, if you saw the early Bugs Bunny cartoons, you'd see these, you know, he looks maniacal. He's got this kind of sloping head, he's kind of creepy.
And he has a creepy laugh.
Yeah. He's not a fun guy. And, you know, later, you know, he develops, he matures. Well, I had to have a mature character, and this is part of that puzzle solving, especially if you've got kids that like a little puzzle solving. I had to come up with a mature character, his arch enemy. What could I do? Well, okay, you know, you always go with the opposite. Well, I'll have to make him a negative Pac-Man. What's the opposite of yellow? You know, could be an artist, you know, get out the color wheel. Purple. Purpley blue. I'll make him blue. And he's Japanese, so let's give him a power armor suit. I'll stick him in a power armor suit. I'll put circuitry all over him. That way he looks like, you know, he's part of it. You know, these are all things that, you know, I even talk to people that, you know, some of my students that you think about these things. And all you need to do is you start with the basic. My basic was Pac-Man. Pac-Man is always being chased by ghosts. You research all this. And again, thinking outside the box. I had a box I had to stick with, and that was Pac-Man. I couldn't change him. That's an IP, that's a signature character, an intellectual property you don't mess with at all. But what I could do was I could take him and flip him and put him in a power armor suit, and then I have the Ghost Lord, and he's in charge of all the ghosts. He's this little circuit, this ghost in the machine. And as soon as we thought about that, you know, my team, I said, he's a ghost in the machine. And they were going, secret of the ghost zone. Because the ghost zone was the little box that the ghosts go back in to regenerate. Yeah. So he would be the king of that. And we said, yes. And he would have to, he would be in charge, and he would be wanting to come into this world, full-blown or whatever. So we built all these levels, and this is where you have a team of people coming in. Everybody adds a little more to it because they see it from a different perspective. You know, some of them will see we got to have a castle, and it's got to have this because the old cartoon show had, you know, and then one other person says, oh no, you know, we got to build something a little different from that because we don't want to be, you know, copying the cartoon show. So you get a team of people to build on that, and it's really exciting. Get your kids to... another good example, Ian McKay's, he does a workshop where he has Yoda, he uses Yoda as an example, and he says we're going to create these little Yoda-eating worms that live in a cave, and they live on this one planet, but all these other planets have those worms, but all those other planets have different atmospheres and different climates, so and they all love to eat Yodas. So this is a normal Yoda planet type where Yoda's having a picnic, he goes into the cave, you know, he has to fight off, you know, how does he make himself immune? How do they, you know, build themselves or evolve differently on an ice planet or a water planet? Mm. And it was a great exercise. You know, it has nothing to do with the Star Wars trilogy
but the interesting thing is when you're creating, because you're having these students build up a Pac-Man universe. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're creating a fantasy world. And when they're doing that, they're not asking about cell phones, are they?
No.
Because this is a world in which cell phones don't exist.
Yep.
And I think when we look at the title of this session, Thinking Outside the Box, one of the things that comes up again and again is trying to get students to think of worlds other than their own.
Yep.
In any way. I taught a course a couple of years ago at the Newberry Library in Chicago of high school teachers who were teaching science fiction and fantasy, mostly teaching AP students. And the two stories they fell in love with as teachable stories, one was a Le Guin story called The Ones Who Walk Away from O'Mellis, which is a purely philosophical experiment in morality. It's essentially a critique of utopianism in which he describes an ideal city, an ideal town, O'Mellis, which is basically the road sign for Salem, Oregon, spelled backwards. Everybody is happy. There's no disease. There's no discontent. There's no crime in this society. And that will continue as long as one single child is kept in utter misery, locked in a basement with subsistence rations, tortured, and with no hope of escape. Yeah. If you release that child, then all the ills of the world will befall O'Mellis.
Yeah.
And the question, of course, and the whole story is based on a William James basically, mm-hmm. thought experiment, philosophical thought experiment. And, of course, that raises the issue, first of all, of how much suffering are you willing to inflict on a minority, in this case a minority of one, in order for the majority good. That gets all kinds of discussions going. And it's a completely philosophical, artificial world. Students aren't asking, well, what state is O'Mellis? And they realize it's an imaginary world. The other story, almost the opposite that these guys and women thought would be teachable, they hadn't thought about it, was a story, I think both of these are actually in the Wesleyan Anthology of Science Fiction, a story by Ted Chiang called Exhalation, in which he invents his entire physics. He invents a world which is solid, a universe of solid chromium, in which these metallic creatures begin to realize that their world is running down, and a robot, a thing, disassembles his own brain to find out what's going wrong. He's completely created an account of what we eventually realize is the second law of thermodynamics in a world in which the movement of air replaces the movement of heat in our own universe. But it also raises the notion of self-investigation. But you cannot say, why doesn't he get on the cell phone? Because the minute you start reading the story, you know, this is in a universe completely unlike anything that I live in. And in order to even understand the story, you have to be outside the box. You have to think, this is a world.
Well, okay, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. I'm thinking, we have what we call science fiction. A lot of people, when they think of science fiction, they think of machines and trappings and different physics and you know, it's really imaginative stuff. And yet, when you look at all your most notable science fiction books, anthologies, short stories, whatever, the most notable ones are the ones about the human condition, about the human interaction.
Yep.
It's mostly, you know, The Handmaid's Tale.
Flowers for Algernon.
Which, to me, that's like, you know,
heartbreaking.
Especially the love interaction where, mm-hmm. you know, he becomes smarter and he reaches a plateau with her, and so they can relate to each other, and then he's too much and then he's too little, you know, it's really heartbreaking. War of the Worlds, the people that our major character he interacts with, and at the end, you know, is his reaction to how we're dealing with those creatures, with this new world. I absolutely adore that story.
I teach Ender's Game every during the science section, and I mentioned before about the whiz-bang thing that students come in looking at, but my students, I find, are much less interested. I mean, they find it all cool and neat, but they're much less interested in the technical aspects of the battle school fights and, you know, the computer and all that stuff, and much more interested in learning about this kid. Not just this kid because he's a genius and at the age of 6 he thinks like he's, you know, 46, not just someone like that, but also in trying to come to terms with someone who leaves the Earth, never comes back to the Earth, ultimately, and while he is gone from the Earth, is doing what he does mostly for the sake of one person, and that's his sister Valentine, on whom everything for him rests. All of his genius, all of his intellect, all of his interest in playing games, and he loves games, that's why it's called Ender's Game. He does love the sort of competition, the competitive aspect, but all of it ultimately boils down to Valentine and saving Valentine. And they are much more interested, I find, in that, in the human aspect of that, than they are in the rest of the science. Now, I don't think in any way that it's just an overlay. I think that obviously Card integrates much of what's going on technologically, obviously, into Ender's story. But the point is that what they connect to is that human element, that human aspect. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, again, to go back to what something I said earlier, part of what thinking outside the box is for them is getting them to think outside the idea that science fiction is about circuits and wires and gears and gadgets and lasers. It is about those things, but it is much larger, in my view, much more an extent of how those things affect us, how those things affect human beings, how human beings affect other things, and how we deal with philosophical conundrums, you know, released by what we do with machines, to machines, from machines, in machines. Those are things that we find that those kinds of questions are the ones that they really are most founded on or interested in, I find, in the classes that I teach.
To me, a really good example is I'm Legend.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you don't like Neville. Neville's insane. But the reason you connect with him is that he's the only one that's normal. He's the one that you can relate to the most.
Yeah.
And yeah, they you know, Matheson does a retail, you know, a reboot sort of the whole vampire thing. But yet there's other creatures that have made a life for themselves. And they're the ones. They're taking over. You know, he's just a legend. And that's something that your kids, when you talk to them about what does technology do to a person?
Yeah.
You know, we've got a lot of sedentary kids that do a lot of eye-hand coordination with the you know, they're playing games an awful lot. They were in front of the computer an awful lot. Eye strain, carpal tunnel. We're having issues with that. Weight gain, sleep problems because the light from the monitors have a tendency to keep people awake long after. Also, now even with game design, you've got kids growing up wanting to be game designers, and they're all thinking about all these input devices and stuff. Now we've got an iPad, and you can use your hand. And the one thing that's in the way of your game is your hand, you know, because we've all been doing this eye-hand coordination. There's some people that are really frustrated because they're playing Fruit Ninja and they want their hand to get out of the way, but yet their hand is the thing that's doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, our technology, again, who was it that said our technology shapes us? He's the guy that they...
Was it Stephen Jay Gould?
No.
Go back before that.
Yeah, he's like, he was like the number one marketer for television.
Did you miss the massage?
Yes, I think so.
Yes.
McLuhan, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
McLuhan. Sorry, another senior moment.
Do we want to take questions? Because we got
no discussion.
We're way over.
Because we started.
I'm sorry. I turned my phone off, so it wouldn't.
What do you need to know from us that? We're actually failing to deliver at this point.
I'm sorry.
What do you start with?
Well, it's interesting you bring this up because I've just been poring over this thought myself. I think I am probably going to start with The Time Machine and no, that's not true. I'm starting with Frankenstein, sorry. I'm starting with Frankenstein, then I'm going to go up to The Time Machine. One of the reasons I'm starting with Frankenstein is exactly what I've been sort of hammering on this whole panel, in that it deals with something which is different from our experience, unusual from our experience, and something which we didn't talk about as much, different for the people in the time about which the book was written, which is really more important in a way than whether we find it different or not. The panel right before us was talking about, there was a lot of sort of discussion of kind of gotcha moments in science fiction, which I have to admit I'm much less interested in. I think nothing shuts down a room faster than telling a bunch of students, no, yes, no, you know, I'm not, if I were really interested in doing mathematical equations, that's what I would teach. And I find that you were talking about a sense of wonder. So Frankenstein deals with that subject, and yet it's familiar enough to them because it's dealing with what does the monster do? Who are we really, right? What kinds of creatures are we, ultimately? And does it matter if we consider ourselves divinely inspired or humanly created? It certainly doesn't matter to the monster in a way, or it shouldn't. That, those sorts of things are questions which are really rich. So it's lots of science fiction, but also a great deal of philosophical discussion as well. And then from there to The Time Machine, and then I move on to a bunch of other things I deal with. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm playing around with the last one. I'm playing around with maybe doing Stanislaw Lem as well. So this is all kind of in flux, and I haven't tied it all together. But that's basically what I start with. And I do want to put in a plug, by the way. I was at ReaderCon about a month ago, and I did a panel with a guy named Lee Grossman, who has a new book out called, I believe it's called Sense of Wonder, which is a massive, massive collection of short stories. In particular, I teach mostly novels in my science fiction course, but he has a whole series of short stories, and it's affordable and massive. I don't really know how he was able to get all these rights. Like, he must have taken him a long time, but I recommend it. I believe it's called Sense of Wonder, and the guy's name is Lee, L-E-I-G-H, Grossman. He's out of the University of Connecticut, and I don't remember the publisher off the top of my head, but I recommend that as something which incorporates a great deal of science fiction and fantasy. So,
the reason I was asking is,
yeah.
I'll be teaching a science fiction elective at a high school.
Cool.
In 5 days. Wow.
Woo-hoo.
And I've got a lot of older material that I'm trying to find and source.
Yep.
And then listening to what Ms. Fisk is saying about pay attention to what's new,
yeah,
and don't get so caught up in presenting some of the originals. You know, appreciate them for what they are.
Well, both. I mean, the originals, but also the new. Yeah.
So I'm looking at some of the books that I can't find.
Yeah.
And thinking, maybe I don't need to. Maybe I need to find something more modern. But I don't know how to balance it.
I'll do an odd plug.
All right.
I did a course that was deconstructing the novelization of Iron Man 2. I chose the book because I figured that most people would have some exposure to the Iron Man movie, at least. In going through it, first of all, it technically, incredibly well written. There are a few hiccups. But, you know, I find hiccups in everything. I'm extremely picky in a continuity monster. But it allowed my students to have something that they could already connect with, that they already knew, that they already thought they knew. And then I could break it down into pieces like theme, which is something that a lot of people have a hard time grasping, because they already know the story. If I put the pieces of story into theme, and they're looking at the book, and they're looking at how those pieces come together, it takes something that's familiar, whether it's really familiar because they've read the book, or whether, I mean, at the point that they're going over it in class, they should have read the book, but...
theoretically.
Yeah.
But it gives, I mean, if you can point to these five passages for them to read in this order in order to demonstrate the philosophy or what element you're trying to demonstrate, because they already know something about it, it's closer to them. It's not, oh, I've got this huge book, I've never read it, nothing makes sense. It's, oh, wow, you know, this book is a heck of a lot deeper than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie just is sad because it's like a pastiche of a really good book. But there's a reason to watch the movie first.
Just one last comment. I would just say the more you can do works in dialogue with each other across years, decades, centuries occasionally, the better. I find especially when you can do, when you can show students something that they might be familiar with or know, and then give to them through a short story or novel something that would have been the root of that, something which the author, him or herself, used, that can be enormously helpful, and it really ties together the field for them and encourages them to want to go back and read some of the origin stories and then tell me, you know, like they saw the iRobot film that came out, the dreadful film, a few years ago, and I had my students left my class, because I teach iRobot, say, you know, we saw that, Dr. Wilson, and you were right. It's nothing to do with it. And I said, yes, yes. Please continue to spread the word, because actually the movie is directly opposite of what Asimov argued, like literally opposite, because it's not the same script. They repackaged another script that had been sent, to Fox. But anyway, so that was an example of something where there was a modern movie or film, you know, or a TV show or a book or something like that that they knew in dialogue with something else. In this case, it was badly in dialogue with it, but it was instructive, I think, either way. So that's the one sort of general, not very helpful maybe, but general comment.
No, I really like the plan.
So. Okay.
Yeah, because we're way over time, and that's my fault. I apologize, but yeah, listen.
For the panel, take a moment and think about it. I'm an engineer. We have the same creativity getting out of the box problems that you do. Mm-hmm. Think about going back and talking to a creative engineer, a systems engineer, ask them how they are dealing with the problem in their discipline, mm-hmm. and you may be able to develop an interpersonal dialogue that will follow both worlds.
I have to say, I worked with a lot of engineers, being in the game industry, a lot of programmers, and people who only spoke in algorithms. Their whole mind and set, everything. And actually, including that part, that brain portion to your mix, your intelligence mix, is so good. It's so creative, because they're anxious to think other than what they're doing. And you give them wonderful.
Yeah, agree. Definitely. Agree.
So I apologize. We're going to be around. I guess you can come up and ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll have to take it outside, I guess.
We'll have to go outside the box here.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.